Okay, we've been talking about the particulars of meiosis, but let's now look at a slide that goes through the subphases, slide 7. It looks very similar to a slide that we looked at for mitosis. The big difference is that there are, well, one of the big differences is that the meiosis features two division events. So it's going through the phases twice, once in meiosis 1 and then once in meiosis 2. The cartoon cell that we see here has what as N? What is N here? What is N in general?
The haploid number.
The haploid number, which means what?
The number.
That's right. How many different kinds of chromosomes are shown in this cell on the left? It is 3. Large, medium, and small. All right. And what's the ploidy? Well, there's 2 of each, but we don't use numerals for ploidy. We use the word, so it's diploid, correct. And that's why there's a red and a blue version of each of the 3 types. N is 3, and it's diploid. And by the way, for meiosis, it doesn't make sense for a haploid cell to enter meiosis, right? A haploid cell already only has 1 of each type, so you can't cut the ploidy in half if it's already only 1 of each. So the whole purpose also of meiosis is to reduce that ploidy. So you start with a diploid cell. All right. Now this actually brings up a slightly different thing I want to get through before we get to the particulars of meiosis. And that is in your body there are 2 major categories of cells, which are called somatic cells and germline cells. Have you heard these terms before? Somatic means of the body. It's kind of a misnomer because obviously they're both part of your body. But the reason somatic kind of makes sense for somatic cells is that by far, the vast majority of your cells, almost all of your cells, are somatic cells. So they make up the bulk of your body. All right. Germline cells are a tiny, tiny population, tiny, tiny minority of the overall cells of your body. And they are found only in gonads, which is a unisex term, just like gametes is. Gametes is the unisex term for sex cells. And they can be either of 2 varieties, like sperm or egg, for instance. Gonads is the unisex term for the primary sex organs of a sexual species. So there's 2 versions. The gonads, what makes a sex organ a primary sex organ is that it is the one that's directly responsible for making gametes. All right, so the primary sex organ in females are the ovaries. The primary sex organs for a male are the testes, because the ovaries produce the eggs, the female gametes. The testes produce the sperm, the male gametes. Anyway, only in gonads do you find this tiny number of cells, comparatively tiny number of cells, called germline cells. The big distinction between them is what kind of cell division they undergo. They are both diploid. Both somatic cells and germline cells are diploid. I'm talking about for humans, because we as animals live our life as diploid multicellular adults. All right? So that's not the distinction. The distinction is that somatic cells, if they divide, divide only by mitosis, well, and cytokinesis, but I'm talking about just the nuclear division part. Somatic cells undergo mitosis, but not meiosis. Germline cells, when they divide, undergo mitosis and meiosis. And the meiosis, since it reduces the ploidy, is what in humans produces haploid cells that are the gametes. Gametes need to be haploid so that when they join with other gametes from another individual to produce a zygote via fertilization, then you're just back to diploidy. You're not doubling it again, right? That's the whole reason you need meiosis, to undo the doubling of fertilization. So somatic cells really just copy themselves. That's what mitosis accomplishes. It makes genetically identical cell, two cells out of one. That's how you grow to begin with, but that's also how you repair your tissues and whatnot. Germline cells are about producing gametes, which is why they undergo meiosis. But why don't they undergo just meiosis? Why mitosis too? Well, I told you that this is a tiny number that you have in your body compared to the enormous number of somatic cells. What happens to a cell that enters meiosis? What happens to this cell on the left? It no longer exists, right? It's replaced by cells that come out at the other end, but this cell no longer exists. And that's why you need mitosis as well. Germline cells, that tiny fraction, if they underwent meiosis only, every time that happened, you would have an even smaller population left behind to undergo meiosis themselves, right? You would deplete the population. So germline cells first undergo mitosis. When an individual germline cell's turn comes up, basically, it undergoes mitosis first. That produces two identical copies. The original one's no longer there. There are two copies, one of which then undergoes meiosis to produce gametes, and the other one stays behind to replace the one that was lost when the first one split. That way you maintain this small population of cells called germline cells. They don't get depleted throughout your lifetime. Understand that? All right. Let's now look at this figure to see what happens during meiosis in each of the important phases. Right away, there is a huge difference in prophase of meiosis 1, or prophase 1, as it's called, compared to prophase of mitosis. The huge difference is that the two homologs of each type, and there's three types here, right? Because N is three. The two number ones, in other words, the two number twos and the two number threes, find each other. That does not happen in mitosis. Remember that what lines up during mitosis, during metaphase, is individual replicated chromosomes, not pairs. The two number ones in mitosis don't care what each other are doing. Well, they do in meiosis. So you see, you don't see six individual things here. You see three pairs of chromosomes. The red and the blue number ones come together, and so on for two through however, whatever the N is. It would be 23 pairs in humans. That coming together, and they don't just find each other, they actually physically cross over. But that coming together is called synapsis. And that occurs in prophase 1. As I just said, they actually cross over during synapsis, which means that they physically cross the chromosome legs, the chromatids, one chromatid from one chromosome and a chromatid from the other chromosome. Notice those are not sister chromatids. One of the two chromatids of an that are sister chromatids in a replicated chromosome, and one of the two chromatids in the other replicated chromosome of the same type, which is homologous to this one, they actually cross over. Let me make it a little longer. I should have used something that's more distinct from black than purple. But they not only cross those legs, but they exchange the material. All right? So this is only happening in one of the chromatids from each. But when they cross over, that crossover point where they actually cross is called
crossover point?
Oh, yeah, the place where they actually cross over. What the hell is that called? A chiasma. That is singular. Plural of that is chiasmata. But chi itself, I mean, it is a Greek X. It's a cross. Okay, so the chiasma, and by the way, God, I gave you the plural because it doesn't have to happen just once. They can also cross over down here, and you can see that there's multiple different chiasmata on this single pair of homologs. Those crossover points, though, aren't just a place where they are meeting. From the chiasma downstream of that, they actually trade their material with each other. All right, and you can see that here with red and blue. Well, maybe you can't yet, but we'll see it on a better slide that's more close up. All right, now, this brings up still another important point before we continue on, and that has to do with sex as a mode of reproduction. We already somewhat discussed asexual versus sexual reproduction, and we said that one of the great advantages of sexual reproduction is that it increases the genetic variety, right? You don't know what you're going to get, but maybe you'll get something that'll be even better fit than you are as the parent. Well, this is kind of like shuffling the deck, in a sense. All right, but sex would not accomplish anything. It wouldn't increase genetic variety at all if there weren't already genetic variety to begin with. What I mean by this is illustrated by this analogy of shuffling the deck. If you have a deck that is nothing but 10 of hearts, you can shuffle that as many times as you want, and you're always going to draw a 10 of heart, right? That's the only thing available. There has to be different cards in the deck for shuffling to do anything. And similarly, there has to already be different versions of DNA for sex, which mixes up the DNA, to do anything. If these two homologous chromosomes were identical to each other because the parents were identical, then crossing over wouldn't change anything, right? They're swapping exactly the same thing with each other. So there has to be already genetic variation for sex to operate on and just increase the variety of. Well, what is the Why is it that there is already, before sex even evolved, why is it already the case that there were different versions of DNA? What's the original source of all genetic variation? Mutation. Exactly. Mutation is the reason that we're not simply exact copies of the original successful cells that we all have as ancestors. Along the way, in copying all that DNA and in being exposed to things that can cause mutation, accidents have occurred. Mutations have occurred. That's the source of all originally of all differences in DNA. And once you have those differences, then natural selection works because different versions of DNA give different abilities to organisms. Once you have variety already in a population because of mutation, then sex can make it a lot more, make that genetic variety a lot greater. Okay? And there's three ways that sex increases genetic variety. Two of which occur in meiosis. Let me give you the three, though. The three sources of additional genetic variation that sex provides. The first is called crossing over. That's what the one I just described. The second is independent assortment. And the third is random fertilization. Now, these all individually increase the variety genetically, but they don't do it equally as well in terms of the mathematical possibilities. Crossing over by itself has a ridiculously huge number of possibilities. Now think about what a chromosome is. Just the DNA part of it. There's one enormously long DNA in a chromosome, right? It has thousands of genes, but it has millions of nucleotides. If you have a million long, just 1 million, which is much smaller than an actual chromosome, but just imagine a string of beads with 1 million beads and another string of beads with 1 million beads. Imagine how many possible ways that you can cross over that. How many different positions you can have for your chiasma. Even if you were allowed to do it only once. And it's even greater if you're allowed to cross it over more than once. The number of possibilities is roughly equal to the number of atoms that are in the universe. It's so high. And so just the number of possible different kinds of gametes that one parent can make simply due to crossing over is enough to mathematically all but ensure that it's basically impossible because of crossing over for there to be two gametes that are identical from the same parent. Now, there's a pretty big difference in humans on how gametes are produced. Females start producing their gametes before they're even born. When they're a fetus in their mother's uterus, they actually start producing their eggs, and then it gets paused for between 10 and 40 years before they actually complete themselves. Men, on the other hand, don't start producing sperm until their teens, and then they produce millions every day for potentially the rest of their life. Even though there are millions of different sperm produced each day by one human, that's a million times however many days he lives. That's a hell of a lot of different sperm But the chance of any two of those sperm being identical is zero, basically, simply because of crossing over, and we haven't gotten to the other sources of variation. And it would still be basically a zero chance if he were able to live for 1,000 years doing that. There's just so many possibilities. This is why you don't have siblings that are not identical twins, which is an accident. You don't have siblings. No matter how many children you have, you'll never have identical siblings. And you don't see identical humans in all of human population, similarly for other organisms, because there's so many possibilities of crossing over. All right? I'll get to these other two in a minute. But crossing over occurs in prophase 1, prophase of meiosis 1. Metaphase 1 is aligning up, right, as you're used to referring to metaphase in mitosis. But remember what we said last time. What lines up in metaphase 1 of meiosis is totally different from what lines up in metaphase of mitosis. So instead of having 6 individual replicated chromosomes line up, which you would in mitosis, you have 3 pairs, 3 homologous pairs lining up. By the way, we can use the phrase homologous pair. That's one of the names. You can refer to the 2 number ones, for instance. You can also call that pair a tetrad, which kind of seems doesn't make sense because pair means 2 and tetrad means 4. The reason tetrad makes sense is because it's a pair of replicated chromosomes. So there's 4 overall chromatids, right? It's two pairs of chromatids, so it's 4 overall chromatids. Anyway, tetrad means the same thing as homologous pair, and still another name that you can use is bivalent. Some books will use that. So what lines up in metaphase of meiosis 1 are tetrads, N tetrads. Here N is 3, so it's 3 pairs that you see. For humans, there will be 23 tetrads lining up. And they've already crossed over previously in prophase. Okay, since that's what lines up, that determines what splits in anaphase 1. And as we said last time, what splits apart are not chromatids. What splits apart are the 2 homologs from each other. The one that came from the father splits from the one that came from the mother. Red and blue separate. All right, and that is why the ploidy gets cut in half. Because each of the 2 cells that's produced when you finally have cytokinesis happening for meiosis 1 is going to get just 1 of each type, not 2, right? The reason this was diploid is because there's 2 of each type. Now you have cells, 2 cells produced from meiosis 1, each of which has just 1 of each type of chromosome. That means each of these is already haploid. So that's when the ploidy reduction takes place. Anaphase of meiosis 1. All right. That accomplishes the overall goal, because the goal of meiosis is to reduce the ploidy. That's already been done, but meiosis needs an additional phase, another division event, meiosis 2, because we haven't yet split apart any chromatids. Each of these cells is already haploid, but each of these cells still has replicated chromosomes, not unreplicated. So meiosis 2 is just like mitosis and does the same thing. What will line up in metaphase 2 are individual replicated chromosomes, but these cells are already haploid, right? Do you see that they're already haploid? Each of them has only 1 of each of the 3 types, whereas this one had 2 of each of the 3 types. Okay, But these are replicated chromosomes still, so they need to line up and then split their chromatids in anaphase too, just like chromatids get split in mitosis. That's going to produce two cells from each of these two for a total of four cells. So meiosis starts out with one diploid cell. Meiosis 1 produces, from that one cell that enters, two cells, each of which are already haploid but have replicated chromosomes. And each of those then enters meiosis 2 to split the chromatids apart, producing two cells from each of those. And the overall product of meiosis, therefore, are four haploid cells from the one original diploid cell. And they are not genetically identical to the original cell, of course. For one thing, they're haploid instead of diploid. But they're also not even genetically identical to each other. This is what I was saying about producing sperm that are different every time. And that's because of crossing over, mainly. But it's also because of independent assortment. Okay? Now, crossing over by itself, already, well, that's the first thing to happen. That already produces a chromosome that has never existed, because it's partly red and the rest blue. It's not like the red one anymore. It's not like the blue one anymore. Right? Depend on which part is red and which part is blue depends on where the chiasma happens to form. But these, you'd have to really look closely. We'll see a better picture later. These chromosomes are already unique. They're unlike any other chromosome that's existed because they are mixed up versions of the other two that this cell had originally. Okay, that's crossing over. Independent assortment happens after crossing over. It happens at metaphase 1. And let me explain this term, independent assortment. The assortment part of this phrase refers to how tetrads line up at metaphase, how a tetrad positions itself. That's just assortment by itself. A tetrad is a pair of homologous chromosomes, right? So there's a red part, there's a red one, or a mostly red one, and a mostly blue one. And those are not identical to each other, right? They came from different parents. So that's why there's two possible assortments that a single tetrad can do. It can position itself. Right here we have the poles top and bottom. So each individual tetrad can line up or assort either with red toward the top and blue toward the bottom, or blue toward the top and red toward the bottom. That's just for one tetrad, okay? Two possibilities. Well, independent assortment refers to the fact that how one tetrad lines up, red up or blue up, in other words, is totally unrelated or independent of how the other tetrads are lining up. Each tetrad lines up one way or the other, just on its own. It is not at all affected by what the other tetrads are doing. And this is entirely analogous to flipping a coin for each tetrad. Right? Each tetrad flips its own coin to determine whether it's red up or blue up. And since they're all flipping their own coins, it's completely independent of all the other tetrads. And therefore, it is not necessarily the case that all the reds will be up and all the blues will be down. It can be on a, it's on a tetrad by tetrad basis. As you see here, two of them have red up and blue down. The other one has blue up and red down. Well, there's still quite a few number of possibilities for this. Not nearly as many as there are for crossing over. But for, in general, since there's two possibilities for each one, the number of total possible ways that you can have assortment is 2 raised to the n minus 1 power. If you really, if your n is 1, there really aren't two possibilities, right? Doesn't matter which way it assorts, it's going to be one cell is going to get red and the other one's going to get blue. But if there are two or more, then there are multiple possibilities. N minus 1 is the exponent here. So for this, there's an n of 3, and therefore the total number of ways that they can assort is 2 raised to the 2, which is just 4 different ways. That's just due to independent assortment. That doesn't have anything to do with crossing over. But as n gets bigger, the number of possible assortments gets bigger, right? So for humans, it's 2 raised to the 22nd power. That's a big number. That's millions of ways just to line up. Now, millions is a big number, but it's tiny compared to the enormous number that crossing over is. But the point here is that you have this already huge number of possibilities for crossing over, and then you multiply that by millions, because there's millions of different ways to then line them up. And that's still not all of the possibilities that sex gives, because this is just, that would, these two just tell you how many different possible gametes can be produced. Now, you don't live long enough to produce all those possibilities, but that's how many mathematical possibilities there are. Okay? Random fertilization, the third source, refers to the fact that when two parents produce offspring, one gamete from each is chosen randomly. And so the total number of zygotes is the total number of gametes that one parent can produce times the total number of gametes the other parent can produce. Well, the number, so that's like drawing a card from two decks, drawing one card from each of two decks, representing the two gametes that get chosen to get put together for the zygote. Each deck is the number of gametes possibly made by each parent, which is almost an infinite number of cards in each deck. So the total number of possible zygotes is close to infinity times close to infinity. It's really staggering what the numbers are. But those three things together are the sources of additional genetic variation that sex brings about. And it would be zero if there weren't already different versions of DNA in the environment anyway. That's why you have to have mutation first, creating that genetic variation to begin with. All right, slide 8 compares side by side mitosis with meiosis. So we've been going through this already, but these are good pictures to look at. Now, one thing about this, though, is that this shows mitosis happening in a diploid cell, but that doesn't have to be the case. Any ploidy, a cell of any ploidy can enter mitosis, because mitosis does not change the ploidy. Remember when we talked about fungi living their life as haploid multicellular individuals? Well, they grow up from a haploid cell that they start out as by mitosis, which produces more haploid cells. So a haploid cell can enter mitosis, no problem. It just produces two haploid cells. It makes no sense to compare a haploid cell in mitosis to a haploid cell for meiosis, though, because haploid cells don't undergo meiosis. That's why you have diploid compared to diploid. And what is the N here? No. There are six total chromosomes. The N is three. There are three types of chromosomes, just like for the cartoon in the previous slide. Right? There's two bigs, two mediums, two smalls. So it's N is three, and it's diploid. For mitosis, notice that what lines up at metaphase are not pairs. The homologue, we don't even use the word homologues in mitosis because they don't care what each other are doing. So it's two N different things that line up in mitosis if it's a diploid cell. Six here, six different things. For humans, it would be 46 different things lining up. Whereas in meiosis one, you have synapses occurring in prophase, right? The two number ones didn't come together in prophase of mitosis, but they do in meiosis. Synapses and crossing over, that produces brand new DNA that has never existed. Not by adding any DNA, simply by shuffling it, making it a combination of the two different parental origin chromosomes, red and blue. And then in metaphase of meiosis one, it's not individual replicated chromosomes that line up, it's tetrads, or homologous pairs of chromosomes. And N of those line up. You have N pairs here. N is three. Three pairs. All right? And then what split apart are homologs. The blue from the red. That's what causes the reduction in ploidy. So the two cells that are created from meiosis one are already haploid, but they still have replicated chromosomes because meiosis one doesn't split chromatids, it splits homologs. That's why you need meiosis two, which operates just like mitosis, to line those replicated chromosomes up and then split the chromatids apart, creating unreplicated chromosomes, or daughter chromosomes as they're called. All right? Meanwhile, in mitosis, you don't have this second splitting. One splitting is enough in mitosis, because you split the chromatids in the only splitting division that occurs. And since you're not separating homologs from each other, you maintain the ploidy. Whatever it is coming in, it's the same coming out. Genetically identical cells to each other for mitosis, the two that are produced, and genetically identical to the original one. In meiosis, you have four cells produced from the one. They're not genetically identical to the original cell, and they're not genetically identical to each other because of crossing over and and independent assortment. So that there are four produced from the one cell, from the one germline cell that undergoes meiosis. There are four gametes produced, but it's just four of almost infinite number of possibilities. So that when another germline cell undergoes meiosis to produce four more, they'll be totally different from this, and effectively so on forever. Okay? So these are the four that happened this time. The next time, a cell that's identical to this one originally, it will cross over differently and independently assort differently, and therefore produce four totally different combinations. Nine is just a summary, so I'm not going to read that to you, but it's important for you to understand what's in words there. It might be helpful to study that. That brings us to 10, and unfortunately, for whatever reason, 10 and 11 are kind of out of order in terms of how it happens in the cell, because 10 shows you independent assortment. 11 will show you crossing over, but just keep in mind, crossing over happens first. Crossing over happens in prophase 1 of meiosis. But here we see independent assortment for an N of 2. Do you see that this is an N of 2? Two different kinds, and it's diploid, because there's two of each of those two. this is the simplest possibility because, I mean, this is the simplest, the smallest n that has multiple possibilities. If you had just an n of 1, then there wouldn't be really two different possibilities, right? It's either going to line up red to the left and blue to the right or the other way around, but those are really the same thing. Because when they split, you produce one cell with red and one cell with blue. When you have two, though, or more, then there are multiple possibilities because each tetrad independently flips its coin independently from the other. In this first possibility, both coins ended up landing so that blue's going to the left and red's going to the right. In the other possibility, the two coin tosses are different from each other. And so one cell gets one red and one blue, and the other one gets one blue and one red. Right? There's no other possibilities just for independent assortment. So this is ignoring the effects of crossing over that happened earlier, actually. This is due just to independent assortment. And if you have a human cell, there aren't just two pairs, there's 23 pairs. So there's really a lot of coins being tossed, and that's why there are millions of possible different possibilities simply due to independent assortment. Well, 11, like I said, happens first. This is crossing over. This is a much better picture to look at and much better than one I was drawing with two inks that are basically the same color. But the process, as I said, of the two homologs, the two chromosomes of the same type in that diploid cell finding each other is synapsis. And when synapsis occurs, crossing over occurs. So and it doesn't have to, but it usually does, and it can more than once, which is part of the variety. And here you see two chiasmata forming. Each chiasma, though, is a crossover point. And they not only cross over, they swap everything from the chiasm to the tip with each other. That's why you now, this chromatid that's partly blue and partly red, and this chromatid that's partly blue and partly red, are totally brand new. Those particular sequences of DNA have never existed before. This all blue one and all red one are old stuff. Those are just like the parents' ones. But the ones that have crossed over are new. And simply because these things are really so long in terms of nucleotides means that there's so many possible different ways crossing over can occur. For each tetrad, plus you have, and then you have to multiply that by the number of tetrads you have, so the numbers get enormous. But this word recombinant refers to a new version of DNA that's a mixture of parental DNA. So parental type or recombinant type are two different possibilities. And we'll use those terms in a different chapter as well. I think that's the chapter. Yes. Any questions before I switch to the other chapter? All right.